Hello and welcome to the first in what will hopefully be a long series of podcasts by Bodywise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland. St Patrick's Hospital Dublin, in conjunction with Bodywise, marked Eating Disorders Awareness Week, 5th to the 10th of February 2007, with an evening lecture for GPs. The lecture included presentations from Dr. John Griffin, Programme Director of the St Patrick's Eating Disorders Programme, Catherine Dunican, Clinical Nurse Specialist on St. Patrick's Eating Disorders Programme, and Catherine Joyce, Communications and Advocacy Officer with us here at Bodywise. The audio you are about to hear are all three presentations given on the night to the invited audience.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll start. My name is John Griffin, and I've been, believe it or not, 35 years now at this hospital, working mainly in the field of eating disorders. And I've been privileged tonight to have two excellent speakers speaking with me, Catherine Dunican, who's one of our key workers on the eating disorder programme, who's really expert at dealing one-to-one and in group with some of our difficult skinny lizards upstairs, and Catherine Joyce, who's kindly joined us from Bodywise, which is an excellent organisation. I've been working with Bodywise for a long time, and they with me, and they really are people who get across the message to the general public, to mums, to dads, and indeed to GPs. And the main speakers tonight are, as I say, the two Catherines. I came to med school in the dark and distant days of 1964, and the icons of the day at that time were people like Marilyn Monroe. When I talk to young kids nowadays about Marilyn Monroe, you might as well be talking about the man on the moon. They've no idea who Marilyn Monroe is, but I can see some people are about my vintage, so we know what size dress Marilyn Monroe took, size 16. And when you tell kids that, if I can be rude, the pin-up girls of that time were size 16, they're absolutely astonished. They can't believe that was the fashion of the day, that you can use the term generously proportioned. We all remember then in 1966 in Milan, a lady called Twiggy walked down a catwalk, and we all groaned inwardly and outwardly, and since then, slim is in Western world, especially among females, and any degree of obesity among females particularly is looked on as being ugly and undesirable. And here we are stuck 40 years on with exactly that mindset. And I have enormous sympathy for kids growing up nowadays. First, kids are growing up too quickly. I think we all know that. I think particularly female girls are being sexualized far too early. But they're certainly being conditioned and programmed to slimness from the earliest age. When most of us were growing up, television was relatively in its infancy. We had maybe one channel and with black and white. We didn't have MTV, we didn't have lots of stations, and we certainly didn't have the internet. And this is something I was going to talk about a little bit later on, but just in case it slips my mind. I don't know whether anybody saw a program on ITN last night called Thinternet, and it highlighted, which to me is the most sinister and dangerous phenomenon I've seen in eating disorders in a long time. There are now sites on the internet called Pro Anna and Pro Mia. These sites encourage young girls, and I'm talking prepubertal girls, and pubertal and adolescent girls, because it's mainly, as we know, a female disorder, to become anorectic and to perpetuate their anorexia as, if you don't mind, a lifestyle. Choose anorexia, be like me, I'm slim, I'm in control. Don't listen to boring mums and dads, don't listen to boring GPs, don't listen to hospital specialists. And these are dangerous, frightening, sinister sights. And twice recently I've seen patients for family doctors, and I've asked the kids where they first got the idea. No, only on two occasions. In recent months, kids have told me that they've logged on to pro-Anna sites, and that's where they got their ideas, and they thought this would be a fashionable lifestyle. I mean, and really what I saw on ITN last night was frightening. They showed pictures and videos of a girl who had dieted down to 3.5 stone. She was on constant nasogastric feeding, and at the end of the program, she died. She died from, effectively, malnutrition. She could not accept weight gain. And the fight we have in our unit upstairs, we have 16 places on the eating disorder unit where we take patients from 14 upwards to any age really, is to get across the barrier that I must put on weight, and when I put on weight, my body image is going to change. So Catherine and the staff upstairs do a huge amount of work on body image and mirror work, helping girls to appreciate that the body image will change as weight goes on. I'm often asked by mums and dads and sometimes by GPs, what are the first signs to look out for? And I often say, in a family where eating disorders, the parasite of an eating disorder, particularly anorexia, has taken hold, often the siblings are the forgotten people. Mums and dads, of course, are involved, especially mums, who are the main carers. Dads to some degree, but the siblings are often the forgotten people. And often it's interesting that the sibling will be the first person to find out about the eating disorder, or the eating disorder patient will first tell a sibling. Or if there's self-induced vomiting going on, as we all know, there are two types of anorexia. One is the restrictive anorexia, where they don't eat or eat very little. But the most serious one of all, of course, is the purging anorectics. The anorectics who do eat, well, well-meaning parents sit down and finish that, or else they go to the loo and put their fingers down afterwards, or take laxatives. The kid last night on the programme was taking 100 Dulcolax a day. 100 Dulcolax a day, which is frightening. But in bulimia, which I'll talk about in a moment, the average intake of laxatives is 20 to 40 a day. They buy two packs a day, 20 to 40 a day. It's frightening what they're doing to themselves. But very often the sibling is the first person to hear the sister in the loo putting the fingers down the throat and vomiting, and often they say, well, listen, if you don't tell Mum, I'm going to tell Mum. So very often that's how it is. But the first signs are the irritability, social withdrawal, labile mood, just difficult to live with. And any mum or any dad who's gone through living with an eating disorder patient will identify with that. They know there's something different here. Now, it could be 101 things, but unfortunately, I have to say this to a group of GPs, my advice to parents always is, look, bring the kid along to the family doctor. The family doctor will have known the child probably since birth and delivery, and he or she will talk to the child, talk to the parents. It could be 100 other things. But if it's anorexia, the old saying in medicine, as we all know, sitting in this room together, is hit the temperature at 99, not when it's 105. Nip it in the bud, because it really pays dividends. If the thing takes hold, and if the attitudinal change has occurred, and this is the whole problem with anorexia, we always say on our program, eating disorder patients get better from the neck up, not from the neck down. You've got to treat this. If that parasite is taken over and the control of the parasite of anorexia is taken over, it's very difficult to treat if it's got to the classical end stage. The last two here are interesting: obsessional thinking and increased perfectionism. In my 35 years in St. Pat's dealing with eating disorders, I don't think I've met one dull anorectic. We call them in our unit the 600 pointers. That 600 points are even not enough. They always seek perfection. They're high achievers in every sense. They're high achievers academically, high achievers on the sports field, high achievers in life. The attitude of it'll do doesn't apply to anorectics, as we know. And the trouble is that high-achieving, driven personality also drives their eating disorders. And they become very good anorectics. They become very good at their anorexia. And most of them are obsessional. Most of them have increased perfectionism. There's a place for everything and everything in their place and their rooms. They're tidy, they're perfectionistic, their books are laid out in a particular way, they're studying till midnight. They always want to get 110% in everything, including their anorexia. So again, almost all anorectics have this obsessional thinking and increased perfectionism. You're all familiar with an anorectic coming into your surgery, and they're the standard things we all see. We almost always see hypotension, disturbed blood chemistry. I often say on my program, I'm paranoid about potassium. The one thing we always ask GPs to do is do a UNE, not so much an FBC, but do a UNE immediately you see the kid. We had it, was it a 1.5 or a 1.9, Catherine, we had that day? We had 1.5. We had and how long was she in the unit when we had to transfer her? About 4 days. We had a kid who came in, and we've since changed our approach. Came in on a Monday, say, and we'd do a UNE maybe on a Thursday, no rush about these things, but she collapsed on the unit, and effectively on heart failure. We got her up to James's by ambulance very quickly, where she had potassium of 1.5. Our policy now is patients come in on a Monday morning, and as they're being admitted, they go straight to phlebotomy. They have EUNE, FBC, T4, TSH, the usual straight away, but particularly EUNE, and we get a phoned result at 4 o'clock that afternoon. Because no matter what patients tell you, vomiting, I've never vomited in my life, or I used to vomit, but I've given it up. You can't believe them. You ask the mums and dads, I don't think she is. No, we can't find any evidence. They're expert at hiding things, as you all know and we all know. So paranoid about personality, paranoid about potassium. This is not a very good slide, but it's the best one I could find on lanugo. Lanugo is the famous soft, brown, downy hair that many anorectics have. This is between the breasts. Not a very good example, but it's the only one I could find. We don't know why patients with anorexia develop lanugo. My own theory is that, as we all know, anorectics are freezing the cold all the time because they're effectively malnourished. And this soft downy hair grows as a sort of a evolutionary thing to keep them warm. As they recover, obviously, the lanugo goes away. The easiest place to see it on the forearms or on the back, but just show it on the slide. One of the things we've taken to doing fairly routinely now are DEXA scans. As we all know, the early signs of osteopenia and osteoporosis can be present in patients with eating disorders. So if we have any doubt at all now, especially with amenorrhea, over a period of time, we'll do a DEXA scan. And 10, 15 years ago, I think Professor Moira O'Brien and Brian and Trinity was the only one who had a DEXA scanner, but they're available now. So pretty routinely we do a DEXA scan now. Anemia, you know, isn't common in anorectics. Even very thin, malnourished anorectics, they often have hemoglobins of 11.4 or 12.4, which is intriguing. And also, later on, I'll come to infections. Swollen salivary glands. If a kid comes into your office and they're known bulimics, and they say, I stopped vomiting and I haven't vomited for 6 months. Have a look here. Swollen salivary glands. If these are up, they're at high, the parotid glands become swollen in vomiting, we don't know, but the average number of vomits per day is 5 to 6 times a day. That's what they do. I had a kid in the other day, last Thursday indeed, and I asked her, what was her pattern like? And she said, everything I eat, doctor, from morning to night time, I vomit. And she counted maybe 13, 14 times a day. She put her fingers down her throat. Watch out as well on their knuckles for a thing called Russell's sign. Russell's sign is sort of indentations on their knuckles as they put their fingers way back their throat, and they have to put their fingers sometimes so far back the knuckles get caught in their top teeth and they become excoriated. But watch out particularly for swollen salivary glands. If they're up, they're at it, no matter what they say. Yeah, bacterial infections and viral infections, as you can probably hear today. I have either a bacterial or a viral infection. Is there a doctor in the house? They don't get them. We get them. It's the month of February today, and most of us sometime this winter will probably get some kind of infection. They're the healthiest crowd I've ever seen. I can't remember when we had to give a... Well, all right, we had a throat last week, cancer, but that was it, and it's rare. They don't get infections, as if some sort of magic wand is waved over them when they get anorexia. But bacterial infections are rare. And I want to stay with that slide for one moment, because quite disturbing me on the programme last night, they keep repeating this mantra that in psychiatry, the highest mortality rate is in eating disorders. Now, I'm only quoting from a very small sample in a very small hospital. We've only 300 beds and 16 places on our eating disorder unit. But in my 35 years, touch plastic, I haven't had one death. Many of my patients, sadly, and your patients, I suppose, have committed suicide from severe depression. Many schizophrenics in their lives. There are many other conditions in psychiatry where people kill themselves or die by their own hand. Not in eating disorders, unless they're not picked up in time or whatever. But so, mortality in eating disorders is, thank the Lord, relatively rare. And it's still in the literature, and it's still in the lay press, and it was quoted last night in that programme itself, or last night on ITN. It's certainly not true in these islands anyway, and I talk a lot to my colleagues in the UK. And I want to talk just briefly, the reason I put that slide up is the myth, if you like, about body image distortion. Again, when I was studying my eating disorders in the 60s, my professor always said that one of the pathognomic signs in anorexia is that they'll have a body image distortion. If you've got anorexia, you can't diagnose anorexia unless they have body image distortion. Body image distortion per se is rare, thank the Lord. Body image dissatisfaction or body image disparagement is common. And the body image distortion always gets better as they begin to gain weight, and the body image disparagement. But one of the things, both individually, what the key workers do on the programme is some of the work is done, the mirror work is done in group, but a lot of the work is done individually because it's a very intimate and a very personal and a very embarrassing thing for a lot of kids to go through. But so body image distortion per se is relatively rare. Socioeconomic levels. Again, in the 60s, the mantra was that you only get anorexia in social classes 1 and 2. Maybe that was the case then, but it's not the case now. We see many anorectics now in what used to be called social classes 3, 4 and 5. Eating disorders are common in all social classes, and eating disorders are common in all social classes because all kids are exposed to exactly the same thing, whether you're living in Fox Rock or you're living in some other part of Ireland or Dublin and are disadvantaged. You're still watching television, you're probably still watching the internet, and you're probably still reading these dreadful magazines that constant highlight diet, 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 slimness, slimness, slimness. I think all of us have been exposed in the last month to these endless headlines of the latest diet and how to lose weight. Every January is going to be the same thing. As we all know, yo-yo dieting is the best way to gain weight. Go on a diet to gain weight. I don't think too many diet companies will tell you that. People with anorexia often unwilling patients, therefore the GP needs to show care and concern for the patient his or her life. It's not simply a matter of treating the illness. And I'm not a GP, and I've never been a GP, but obviously in your busy surgeries on a Monday morning, if you see a skinny kid outside with the mum and or the dad, she's coming in to you terrified out of her wits that your role is going to make her FAT. And if you refer her onto a fellow like me, she thinks my role is going to make her FAT. And this fear of actually normal body weight, it's not fatness. And we've given up this standard insurance weight chart. We do BMI now. And all we ask our patients is to get to the bottom level, the minimal level of BMI. And then we explain what BMI is. And the average weight gain, Catherine may be talking about this in a moment, we ask them to put on, guess how many pounds a week we ask our anorectics to put on? Yeah, exactly. Just one. Because they can manage that down here, and they can manage that up here. So half a kilo, if we ask them to put on half a kilo a week. Later on, we'll ask them to put on 0.75 of a kilo, pound and a half, pound and three quarters a week. But that's all, because that's all they can manage. They can't do anymore. But the fear of loss of control, and just because we had a very sad hour and a half this morning with a CSA case, the most intractable patients are those with child sexual abuse. If a child has been abused at 8, 9 or 10, effectively, as we all know, their femininity, their innocence, their part of their person and personality has been taken away. And very often what they'll do is escape into an eating disorder. It can be anorexia or it can become bulimia. As a safety net, as a kind of a golden cage around them. And then their parents are bringing their kids to people like yourselves or myself or to Catherine to get them better. And of course, the old mantra in medicine, as we all know, don't look at the symptoms, look at the cause. And so sadly, one of the questions we always have to ask early on is there any question of CSA? And it needn't, as we well know, be penetration, fondling, even looks or comments at a particular age, especially coming into puberty, can be devastating for the child. And the child escapes, if you like, into their anorexia. And anorexia, the patient said to me the other day, "Doctor, you're asking me to give up my friend. She's the only friend I've had in the world. I can trust my friend." She kept talking about my friend. And I kept saying, "That's a parasite." "Oh no, it's my friend. She has saved me. She's with me all the time." These are the kind of words they use. "So you're going to take away my friend, the one support I have?" Almost like taking the bottle away from a drinking alcoholic who has no insight. So it must be absolutely terrifying for a patient to come in to a fellow with a striped suit who's going to put weight on, because that's all they see. And as Catherine will talk about in a moment, we run our program on a contractual basis. We actually ask the patients to take away a copy of the contract and to actually sign a contract before coming in. Now, often we see the signature of the patient may be very similar to the signature of the parents, but it doesn't matter. That there's some degree of, well, at least the patient knows roughly what they're in for, so to speak. I'll let Catherine go through that in a moment. But but at least to some degree of motivation and commitment from day one if they do sign a contract. And generally it works very well because they all have to do the same thing. And like the famous therapeutic community, that's how we run the program, that the patients themselves are the therapists, if you like. Catherine and Tony and Joe, the others on the program, often do sit with the patients eating, but they can take a back seat because very often the patients are the therapists themselves. Mary has got to eat it, Jacinta has got to eat it, and Joanne has got to eat it, and if somebody is leaving a pee behind, very quickly the others will step on it. Low self-esteem, low self-image, low self-confidence. For kids who are objectively very successful in life, very successful at sport, very successful academically, very successful socially, they feel a sense of failure, that they're useless and worthless and hopeless or whatever, or even let people down. So a lot of the work that Catherine and the staff do are working on self-esteem, self-image, self-confidence to help them to see the good in themselves. I hate this word, but it's the only one I can think of. It's a holistic approach. And again, we say this on day one to our patients and to our parents, that it's not just come in here, go to bed and put on weight. In fact, there isn't any bed on the program apart from sleeping at night and apart from something called the exception program. When treated early, most patients with anorexia nervosa have a good outcome. The GP is a key role in this process. In fact, we see very few anorectics in our program because most of them are treated very successfully by the GP. Medical complications are actually rare. Resumption of normal eating patterns rapidly restored. Just one quick, I didn't mention this, in bulimia. Bulimics are the ones who, the best way of describing bulimia, it's a failed method of dieting. They start off at 8.5 stone, they end up at 8.5 stone because they starve themselves, they then binge on enormous amounts of food, put their fingers down their throats maybe 5-6 times a day and get rid of it, and or take huge amounts of laxatives. One of the problems is, of course, every time they vomit, they lose enamel from their teeth. And I remember about 10 years ago, a girl coming into me, and she was 26, and she told me that she had bulimia for 10 years, and she went to her dentist. And her dentist gave her, this was in the old days of pounds, her dentist gave her an estimate for her teeth, £32,000 he was charging her to replace her teeth. All of her teeth had been destroyed by constant vomiting. Now, it's again one of the things we don't do the skull and crossbones approach early on, but it's one of the things to look out for. £32,000. Ask Catherine Doolittle to come and talk. Is that?
Hello, everyone. I work with Dr. Griffin on our eating disorders unit here in St. Patrick's, and I'm just going to speak about a brief overview of eating disorders and the categories and their clinical presentation, and then I'll end up with a talk about what we do on our eating disorder unit itself here. We here in St. Patrick's, we deal with three categories of eating disorder: binge eating disorder, anorexia nervosa, and bulimia nervosa. The binge eating disorders DSM-4 research criteria describes it that it has to have three or more of the following: rapid eating, eating uncontrollably full, large amounts when not hungry, eating alone, feeling disgusted, depressed, guilty, marked distress regarding binge eating. And binge eating occurs at least 2 days a week for 6 months. But the difference is that there's no associated compensatory behaviour with this type of disorder. There has been a marked increase definitely in this disorder and can sometimes be mixed up with bulimia, but it is a totally different one, and the NICE guidelines have particular treatment for this on its own. Anorexia nervosa, the DSM-4, is refusal to maintain body weight above 85%, amenorrhea, dysmorphobia, and intense fear of becoming fat. On clinical presentation, we see these girls with weight loss and weight preoccupation. Amenorrhea for about 3 to 4 months is generally a sign that this has become a serious problem. The dysmorphobia becomes more serious when the weight is below 5 kilos of a BMI of 19. This can be confused sometimes with delusional states, and this distorted perception of self then reduces the person to low self-worth and low self-esteem. The intense fear of fat leads them to have, it occupies all their thinking, and they're unable then to deal with other issues. And when this intense fear of fat becomes so overwhelming, they begin this process of mirror gazing, and you will see with your patients when they come, and you can ask their families what they might have seen, and this mirror gazing will be for long hours spent in front of a mirror at home, either in their bedrooms or bathrooms, where they would be pinching, checking, measuring for all types of changes within their body, and anything that they would perceive as any bit of slight difference in weight gain would cause great distress. Lanugo, as Dr. Griffin has shown, in the quite underweight people we get here, you would get quite a lot of lanugo, mainly on the back and the arms initially, unless it becomes into a bigger problem. This then leads, in order to support their desire or their intense fear of fat, leads to the bizarre food and eating habits. And their parents might have seen them, you know, hiding food or cutting up food into small pieces, shaking while they're eating, choking food or trying to gulp food down in order to get rid of it as quick as possible or to get away from the table as quick as possible. We actually had a woman that we were confusing her with an OCD. She used to bizarrely clean her knife and fork every time she'd start and every time she'd finish in between her meals, but it was this intense fear of even the crumbs or the piece of food that was still in her fork was to her more calorific value that she was trying to avoid. The overactivity, it can get as far as, we had a girl there recently who used to run 10 miles before her breakfast. Her breakfast consisted of only an apple. They could walk. We had Dr. Griffin, remember this last we used to have, she was walking from Mayo to Galway. We had proof of it, you wouldn't believe it, but she could do it, and she could do this without even her parents or her GP knowing. Sometimes these girls, even at rest, they can manage to shake uncontrollably, and we have an exception program here, and we would sometimes wonder how somebody who is on bed rest can actually lose weight, but they can actually shake so much underneath the bedclothes without anyone's attention coming to it that they can actually manage to lose weight by doing this. Sometimes they wear very little clothes because in the cold they would just tremble, and they would equate this to helping to lose more weight. The prevalence of anorexia is usually about 0.5 to 1% of adolescent girls, and the age of onset is usually 13 to 20 years. Male and female ratio 1 to 9 and 10. More common in middle and upper socioeconomic groups, but as Dr. Griffin said, we're now seeing just a difference right across the board. Increased incidence in monozygotic twins and sisters. Bulimia nervosa, the DSM criteria for that is recurrent episodes of binge eating, recurrent compensatory behaviour, and the above behaviours, if these are recurring at least twice a week for 3 months, self-evaluation is influenced by body shape and body weight. They will often present as normal weight, but these sufferers, they can binge so much that it can actually result in great pain and great distress. Self-induced vomiting will usually occur afterwards, and the misuse of laxatives up to 30 or 40 a day. But these girls function on that, and they live their lives and go to work or go to college and can manage to function with having their 30 or 40 Dulcolax in the morning, and they would come back and they would have their 30 or 40 in the evening, depending on what they had eaten. You would imagine that they would just be at home in the toilet all day, but they can manage to control themselves so much that it can be well hidden. In bulimia, mood disturbance is more prevalent than it is in anorexia, so you need to watch out for depression, really, in bulimia. No, I was back there. The poor impulse control and substance abuse. Sufferers from bulimia can also suffered, they would have poor impulse control, they would sometimes, we would notice some promiscuity, and alcohol abuse, drug abuse, theft can all go along with symptoms of bulimia. Prevalence 40 to 50% of secondary school and college students. Age of onset is generally older than anorexia, 16 to 18. Male-female ratio generally can sometimes be the same. An increased incidence of family mood disorder and obesity. The risk factors of the individual, this would be for both sets, the psychological and psychiatric risk factors, like 35% of bulimics have a history of depression preceding their eating disorder, and 35% of anorexia have a premorbid of an obsessive compulsive type of personality. The physical risk factors, premorbid obesity, 7 to 20% of our anorexics would have had a premorbid obesity, and 10 to 40% of bulimics. Sufferers from diabetes and sufferers from metabolic disorders and endocrine disorders would have a premorbid. they would be more prone to these eating disorders. Adverse life events, as Dr. Griffin said, CSA, bereavement, separation would really increase the risk. Social and culture factors, then the media, the strive for thinness, Twiggy and the size zero, and the thinking now that thinness just equates to success and is regarded as attractive. The differential diagnosis in the psychiatric, you have to watch out for affective disorders, your personality disorders, disturbance generally with bulimics, but 10 to 40% of bulimics can have similar of borderline personality disorder traits and would generally need a psychological assessment to differentiate between. With schizophrenia, the paranoia, displayed in schizophrenia, re-food and the olfactory hallucinations and visual hallucinations and restlessness around food can sometimes be mistaken for eating disorder, whereas you'd have to make sure that schizophrenia was outruled. OCD, this quite often predates, the anorexic tendencies. And then, of course, substance abuse and the weight loss associated with substance abuse has to be looked at. The differential diagnosis, the physical, as Dr. Griffin has gone through there, the infections, thyroid, diabetes, those sort of things. The best practice guidelines from the American Psychiatric Association, as you see here, the medical stabilisation, what to watch out for in that is the refeeding type syndrome that can result in, if somebody is very underweight and they begin to eat quite rapidly or refed too quick, you can have cardiac problems, breathlessness. We would find generally that our girls would have low blood sugars and we would have to keep a quite good check on that, and low BPs. Nutrition, rehabilitation, you have to rehydrate as well, diet and supplements. The interruption of compensatory behaviours, we would do that with CBT type groups and CBT cognitive behaviour type referrals. We have a dietitian for the psychoeducation of the nutrition and identification and management of the psychological aspects. We would deal and be looking out for all of us with the OCD, CSA, anxiety, stress and grief. And then the comorbid conditions of schizophrenia and affective disorder, you always have to be aware of those. The management, in particular, the NICE guidelines have suggested for bulimia nervosa is an evidence-based self-help program. And there's a CBT developed in up the north and in England at the moment, particularly for bulimia. And they recommend 60 to 20 sessions. Interpersonal psychotherapy, 8 to 12 months. And then trial of antidepressants, the SSRIs, for the impulse control. The management of physical symptoms, the parotid enlargements, and then just to give advice about dental hygiene and dental care, and the advice about if you know that somebody is binging and vomiting quite a bit, the advice about, you know, not to brush teeth directly after vomiting, and to, you know, to be careful of their acid-based foods, or if they're binging on something that's acid-based, you know, while they're trying to control their binges, can they change it to something else? Because with 32,000 of a bill for dental repair work, you know, you don't want this person with that at the end of when they come out of this problem and when they are recovered to have further problems that could have been prevented by some smaller measures. Psychopharmacology, which you're all aware of, is the antidepressants. The SSRIs would be the ones of choice for eating disorder, mood stabilisers and the affective disorders. Antipsychotics, usually the second generation is what we'd use here, and then the anti-anxiety agents. And this is just a graph of a few studies that shows the outcomes of different combinations of treatments and what their outcomes are. There's family therapy, individual therapy, CBT, nutritional counselling. CBT, individual therapy, and routine treatment, McIntosh et al., would be the one that would be somewhat similar to what we do here in St. Patrick's. We would have a combination of that plus other factors like family therapy and that added to it. And that brings me on then to the eating disorder programme that we have here in St. Patrick's. It was established about 20 years ago. It's currently the largest inpatient unit here in Ireland. We cater for 7 inpatient beds and 9 daycare patients, 16 in total going through our system. We cater for patients, both male and female, from 14 years upwards. Like the oldest lady we had there recently, she was about 48. And we take referrals from both north and south of Ireland. It's a 24-hour care for our inpatients, and they stay from a Monday to a Friday. as I say, 7 inpatient, 9 daycare. We use a multidisciplinary approach and it's a 3-stage programme. This is our multidisciplinary team. You can see here it's self-explanatory. Psychiatrist, specialist, family therapist, OT, CBT, referral. We have a 3-stage programme, inpatient, daycare and aftercare. On our inpatient programme, generally the minimum stay is 2 weeks. That's both for assessment for us and for the patient to assess us and see are we suitable. They have previously met with Dr. Griffin or Tony O'Connor, my colleague above, and they have signed the contract, which explains all this part, all these 3 stages of the programme. But there's always questions and there's always doubts and there's always, you know, second guesses at it. So there's a 2-week assessment. Now, generally, if somebody is quite underweight, they stay longer, or it depends on what their progress is. They're assessed by the team 2 weeks into the programme, and then that assessment determines whether they would warrant a longer stay or whether they can progress to our daycare facility. Our daycare facility runs from about 10:30 to 4:30, 4 days a week, and it's ascending days for 8 days, resulting then that we would have our clients down to 1 day a week when they're back living their normal lives, either in school or college or home or working or whatever, and still coming just for the support of the 1 day a week. And after this, then we have our aftercare, which can go on indefinitely, as much as anybody wants to use it for. But usually people will come for about the 6 months and reduce it then to one night. The aftercare is 1 night a week of a Monday night. And within our programme here, we have various therapeutic interventions. And we have, as you can see here, we do a goal attainment group, which is 3 groups setting and achieving goals. We have an education group which deals with medically related issues, and our registrar meets with the clients once a week for topics that they want discussed. Personal development here that you see is communication. It deals with communication and their relationship to life and life experiences, and that's done on a group basis, plus we have reflective practices and reflective writing of different issues on personal and one-to-one in this personal development OT groups. Self-esteem group, as you know, Dr. Griffin was talking about self-esteem as a big issue within eating disorders, and our registrar runs that once a week for our clients. Dietitian group, we have a visiting dietitian who does individual assessments on all admissions, and then she runs a group each week for the group for the total of our programme. Body image is a big thing that we deal with here, and we deal with sort of 3 main aspects of body image. The perceptual disturbances and, you know, the inability to see the body as a whole. Generally, girls with these problems, or boys for that matter with these problems, fail to see their body as one. They break the body up, or they see their head, or they see their arm, or their tummy. They have difficulty in seeing themselves as a whole person. So this would be something that we would target big time. And then how body image, of course, interferes with all areas of your life, especially intimacy and interpersonal relationships. Cookery. We have a cookery session once a week, which they actually quite enjoy, because generally people with eating disorders like to feed everybody else. Mirror work is something that Dr. Griffin mentioned as well, and this is something which they quite find quite helpful, because their ideas can be challenged within a safe environment in our mirror work room, where we have a particular large wall mirror, and we do groups and then ended up with individual work, and they're guided through their difficulties with body image with particular type of exercises. We have individual psychotherapy, which is we have referral to CBT, and that can, for a lot of their OCD problems that are dealt with there. We also have referral to psychodynamic psychotherapy, and our psychological assessment is available to all that we refer to. Family therapy is available as well to everyone on the programme. Everyone on the programme gets an assessment probably towards the end of their daycare, and the family and the individual are invited to ongoing monthly sessions with our family therapist. She then sometimes actually takes the individual themselves for further individual work if necessary. And our aftercare, as I've previously mentioned, runs for about 18 months for anyone that wants it. After that, the future of our eating disorder programme, we hope to add a family support group to add on to our Monday night, because we find that a lot of parents, especially with the under-18s, the parents accompany these children to the unit, and they sit down and try and have coffee or wait somewhere, or have to go off and drive around Dublin and come back if they've driven distances. So hopefully in time, with appropriate staffing levels and that. We hope to increase our bed capacity to 10 beds. Eventually, that would be our plan for the future further. And then, of course, research. And research is necessary to keep us ticking over and to find out the places that we need to challenge and what we need to work on. We've identified a lot of issues and a lot of areas that we would often say that we will follow on through. So hopefully after about 18 months to 2 years of our current programme up and running, we can begin to have research, because if it had been a long-term problem, we figure about 2 years to look back on what we've been doing, or to look back on how we can improve on what we're doing, would be the appropriate time. So that is that. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Catherine number two now, Catherine Joyce, if we could join us tonight.
Good evening. As Dr. Griffin said, my name is Catherine Joyce. I'm Communications and Advocacy Officer with Bodywise. Bodywise is the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland, and as Dr. Griffin mentioned, we basically aim to provide support, information and understanding for people affected by eating disorders. So that would be people with eating disorders and also then family and friends. We also aim to raise awareness of eating disorders, and we've added lobbying and advocacy work in the improvement of services for eating disorders in Ireland. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our understanding of eating disorders, the angle that we would come at it from, and what recovery would look like to us, and then the role of support services in that. So just to start off with, Bodywise's understanding of eating disorders. Primarily, we would see eating disorders as a coping mechanism, or really a symptom of underlying emotional or psychological distress that a person might be experiencing that they can't find another way to cope with or to deal with. And very often then the behaviours become a distraction to that, and the focus on food will become a distraction to actually looking at those issues that they're trying to avoid. Control, obviously, and I think both previous speakers have mentioned control in this. Control obviously plays a very strong role in that, where the person might not feel that they have control over their outside world or their outside life, or they don't feel safe in that kind of sense of control of their world, that they turn to the behaviours of the eating disorder to maintain control over that one aspect of their life, to deal with that kind of fear around not being able to manage anything else outside of that. So the function of the eating disorder can make it difficult for them to move away from those behaviours. So it's really very difficult for someone to give up that, even if they're ready, even if they've kind of reached the stage of recovery where they're ready to let go of, they're ready to deal with the underlying issues, they're ready to tackle those head on, but the behaviours become such a focus and such an element of control that they can be very difficult for them to let go of in the end. Therefore, as both speakers mentioned, resistance to treatment is normal, and as Dr. Griffin said, fear of letting go of those behaviours can be immense. And then it resolves feelings of low self-esteem. We would see self-esteem and self-confidence, self-worth, those kind of issues as being really vitally important in the function of eating disorders. If people are dealing with those feelings of low self-esteem or feelings that they're not achieving appropriately, or they're not achieving as much as they think they should be, then again the focus on the behaviours and the focus on the food and control over the body takes away from that feeling and allows them to suppress that and not really look at the issues. And their recovery is therefore, for us, really about building up their self-esteem and building up the person's sense of self-worth and helping them to find alternative coping mechanisms in dealing with the issues and any issues that come up after that then as well. So what does recovery involve? We would think it involves awareness, that the person needs to be aware of themselves, aware of how they're responding to emotions, to feelings, to problems that are coming up, and so that they're not simply reacting with the behaviours that they've learned to react with, but that they're actually developing self-awareness and insight as to what they might be using those behaviours for, or what function that might be serving for them. And with that kind of insight, I think was the word Dr. Griffin used earlier, with that kind of insight, there's a shift then from the disordered thinking of the eating disorder to a more rational assessment of what's really going on with them. And then with that growing awareness and with greater control over the thinking, the person's confidence and self-esteem will begin to develop with that. Recovery involves freedom and independence, becoming free from the food and the behaviours, and allowing themselves to let go of that and regain their sense of self-worth without that control over food and body. It involves overcoming the fear and maintaining, like separating that kind of sense of control and suppression of fear from the behaviours and from food and body image. And then ultimately facing those challenges, coming through them, and that sense of achievement will enhance somebody's personal independence and brings a sense of freedom. So what does recovery look like? It'd be a belief and knowledge that the person can cope emotionally, that they don't have to rely on these behaviours to deal with the emotions or feelings that they're finding difficult. Being able to make choices that are separate to the eating disorder behaviours. Learning to live in the present. Challenging the eating disorder rules, so being able to, again, to come away from those behaviours and that you don't have to engage in these to maintain control. And responding to a sense of self which isn't based on food and body control. Obviously, it can be a very long process. So three aspects of recovery. You have to take it slowly and understand learning is an active process and that it is a process and it's a step-by-step process. It's not an easy task. And really, we would see dealing with the underlying issues of what's really going on for the person as being key to recovery. Then it involves lapsing and learning how to cope with the lapses and learning how to see those relapses if they do happen or even what someone sees as a step back, that each step is a new challenge and that each step has to be learned from and moved on from, and a form of relearning which involves constantly kind of assessing where they are, assessing where they've just come from and what the next step is. When I said earlier, even if somebody has got to a point of recovery where they might be ready in themselves to let go of the behaviours or ready to let go of the eating disorder, but really feeling safe about that, so not pushing that, not rushing it to a sense of completion of recovery, but really getting to the point where they feel safe that they can cope without those behaviours. And the key to that really is that the person plays an active role in their own recovery, that is not forced upon them, it is not something that happens without their cooperation, that really it is something they have to be involved in. So recovery involves a learning not to use food to cope. Maintaining control was necessary when all the emotional chaos was going on underneath those behaviours, but then really coming away from using food control and those behaviours as a coping mechanism, that the feelings are actually dealt with when they come up, that feelings are experienced and that disconnection is stopped. Recovery involves restoring a sense of safety that is not reliant on food and body control. So the significant moments of recovery can be initially that a family or friend express concern about somebody's eating behaviours or the other kind of symptoms where they would seem withdrawn or maybe changing behaviours, changing moods, changing kind of personality. The next step may be that the person feels readiness to seek help but then experiences a reluctance to really engage in the process, to fully make the move towards letting go of the eating disorder. And then obviously when someone has looked at the underlying issues, has an increased sense of self-awareness, then is really actively wanting to seek help and wanting to recover. The treatment and support process. We would say change can be very, very slow, and obviously there's an immense amount of frustration both on behalf of the person experiencing the disorder and then from family and friends around the person who don't necessarily understand exactly what's going on with the person and are eager for them to just stop the behaviour and to get on with life. That's obviously quite difficult then for the person themselves as well to cope with that kind of external pressure. But fundamentally important is that the change happens at the pace that the person can dictate so that they can maintain control over their recovery themselves as well, so that all control is not being taken from them, which obviously would make giving up the eating disorder that little bit more difficult. So the pace of change, they can dictate it and it's sustainable for them. So it's not like a massive rush to get better, but then not long-term sustainable. And really that's about building up the person's sense of self and their self-esteem. And key to that, I mean, from anyone around them, is really acknowledging the fear the person is experiencing and why it is so frightening for them to let go of the eating disorder. And again, to see relapse is not necessarily a negative thing, to see it as a step in the process. It is all a process, and recovery is often a long process, and that relapse is not necessarily a really negative backward step, but is something to learn from, and encouraging the person to learn from that and then to move on with the next step. So the role of support, and this would apply to all support, whether it's support services from my BodyWise or support that we would kind of encourage, you know, in if we're advising maybe family and friends of what they can do, or even again as GPs or people working with eating disorders. Support is really about acknowledging what the person is going through and really facilitating them to express how they're feeling and to kind of get to grips with what might be really going on. And key is really accepting the person where they are now, and that's something that we would highlight for family and friends particularly, that if you're approaching someone, that you approach them with a sense of acceptance and non-judgment of where they are right now, what they're going through and what they're feeling with that, and not immediately trying to push them away from it, try to push them forward with recovery. You know, once you've come from that place of acceptance and not judging them, then you negotiate with them the next step that they might be willing to take towards recovery. And part of that then is obviously conveying an understanding of the role the eating disorder is playing in their life, so that, that you have that, that fundamental understanding of why they might be maintaining those behaviours and why they're so afraid to give them up. So what does that mean then for GPs? So not coming from the medical, but in terms of trying to deal with somebody who's presented to you. The response to anything they're telling needs to convey an understanding of the complexity of eating disorders and needs to really acknowledge and demonstrate recognition of the underlying issues that are going on for someone and the emotional distress they might be experiencing. And to take that focus off the food and off the eating behaviours initially to really convey the understanding of what's going on with the eating disorder. And then again, like I've said before, it's vital to include the person in the next step of recovery so that you're not forcing that recovery on them, but really trying to include them in a sense of control over that recovery. The BodyWise support services. We run a national helpline. All our support services are facilitated by trained volunteers. So we run a national helpline 5 days a week, which last year experienced a 38% increase in calls. So it's kind of growing steadily and constantly. We have 4 support groups nationwide, and there's one in Dublin, Carlow, Maynooth and Galway. And each of those support groups would have 1 group for people with eating disorders and 1 group for family and friends, and at the same time usually. We have an online support group, BodyWise Connect. It runs 5 times a month, so it's 5 nights a month. And that really is in response to, you know, resources and our inability to provide support groups completely nationwide at the moment. But also BodyWise Connect, it speaks to, you know, maybe a younger age range, people more comfortable with internet, and people are not necessarily ready to go to face-to-face support groups, but want to keep that sense of anonymity so that they can discuss fully maybe what they're feeling and what they're experiencing. We also have an email support, which people send emails to, and again are answered by volunteers. Within 3 days, the answers are sent. We've also just started running message boards. At the moment, we're piloting a forum for under-25s, and it's been really successful so far. There's been a good number of threads running through it, and a good number of a lot of mutual support in that as well. Like people kind of experiencing an eating disorder, helping each other kind of come through it, and answering questions about, you know, maybe recovery or treatment, things like that. And we also have a comprehensive website at bodywise.ie. And the website really has kind of details of all our support services, a range of information for media, but also for parents, friends, anyone who just wants to inform themselves a little bit better if they're going to approach a family member or a friend who might be going through an eating disorder. So really all our support services provided reflect our understanding of eating disorders. So where we would understand them as being a coping mechanism about those underlying issues, our support services really encourage discussion of how people are feeling, and whether that's how they're feeling about the behaviours that they're engaging in or how they're feeling in general. But we really try to take the focus off behaviours and away from that. So even, say, on our message board or our online support group, really it is coming away from discussing behaviours. We try not to let people get too far into kind of talking about what they're doing, but more how they're feeling about what they're doing or how they're feeling underneath that. And really it's about providing that safe space, the non-judgmental environment, where people can really discuss what's going on for them without kind of and get mutual kind of understanding and support from other people there. And people contact us at all stages of their eating disorder. So we get people, you know, maybe just going through it, starting to go through it, but then also people who kind of have come through it and it can often serve as aftercare, really. If people have come out of treatment programs as well, they very often will use our support groups, if there's one near them, to just kind of, when they feel the need to talk about what they're going through or maybe setbacks and things like that, they'll contact our support services. Recovery is a feeling calm. Really, we see recovery as about building the person back up, building up their self-worth, building their self-esteem, allowing them to change their perceptions of themselves and maybe the world around them. And it's about letting go of the disordered thinking. It's letting go of the fear and the guilt and shame, and really about changing how they see themselves and how they feel about themselves. And in doing that, letting go of the eating disorder, ultimately. Thank you.